The Rokeach, one of the Rishonim, says that the idea of Sfiras HaOmer is the following. He says, between Pesach and Shavuos was the time of harvest. First the barley harvest, then the wheat harvest, as it is recorded in Megillas Rus. They were busy in the fields throughout that entire period of time. And there was a danger that they would forget when Shavuos was. So the Torah instructed them to count the days between Pesach and Shavuos so they wouldn't forget when Shavuos was. And they counted Dafke at night when they weren't busy with the harvest, so they'd remember to count. Very difficult. First of all, the Torah gave this mitzvah already in the desert. When there was no harvest, right? And they were counting the Omer, the Chora, already in the desert. And in fact, it's based on the fact that they knew that they were going to get the Torah after 50 days, and they counted anxiously towards the giving of the Torah. So what's the correlation between what happened in Eretz Yisrael with the harvest and that they shouldn't forget Shavuos, right? Send out messengers to remind people or whatever. What's this concept? So first of all, I want to say that in the desert was the same thing. In the desert, what did they do between the time they left Egypt and crossed the Red Sea, at least, and got the Torah? So the Torah records a few different things, and all of them are involved with setting up their daily gashmiyistika routine. That's when they got the man, and that's when they got the be'er, right? Their routine of what was going to provide them with their sustenance, food, drink, and so on, throughout the 40 years in the desert was established during those 2 months before the Torah was given. So basically they were involved in their material needs, setting up their material needs for the rest of the time they would be in the desert before they got the Torah, which is exactly parallel to what happened in Eretz Yisrael during that time. They were involved in harvesting their crops, which provided for their physical needs for the year. And therefore, what the Rokeach means, I think, is the following. The danger wasn't that they would forget completely when Shavuos is and just forget to celebrate it, and therefore they had to count the days. What he means is forgetting is not necessarily you forget something completely. I'll bring you a proof. Forgetting means it doesn't make an impression on you. You remember it, but it doesn't make an impression. That's also called forgetting. The proof is the following. Rivka tells Yaakov, run away, stay by my father for a time until Esav will forget what you did to him. And then you'll be able to return. Now, do you ever think that Esav forgot what Yaakov did, took away his brachas? He just woke up one morning and just was erased out of his memory? I'm sure he remembered it for the rest of his life. But forgetting means it won't make an impression. He won't be angry anymore. He's not going to be so angry he's going to kill you. That's what forgetting means. It becomes dimmed in a person's memory that it doesn't make an impression on him anymore. The same thing goes, there's a mitzvah to remember Maimed Har Sinai, to remember the giving of the Torah at Sinai. From that same mitzvah we learn that if anybody forgets anything they learn, they transgress a prohibition. Forget things. What's the connection? Connection is that if you remember the giving of the Torah like it happened today, then how could you ever forget any Torah that you learn? If every Torah you learn is remembered with the sharpness of it being given from Har Sinai, you could never forget such a thing. If you forget Torah you learn, that means that it's not clear and fresh in your mind that God gave the Torah on Har Sinai. So they go together. But again, forgetting does not mean you forget the thing completely. It means it doesn't make an impression on you. And therefore, I think what the Rokeach means is the following. People were involved in the 2 months after leaving Egypt with their material, daily, physical needs, setting it up for what's going to be in the desert. Year by year in Eretz Yisrael, they're involved with their the daily parnasa, that they were securing for the whole year by the harvest. And the danger would be that they would forget Shavuos, not forget it completely and not celebrate it, but it would not, the importance of the Torah would be dimmed because of the importance of earning a living. And because they were earning a living, they wouldn't realize how important that the Torah was of supreme importance, and this was only secondary. As it says in Pirkei Avos, Asei Malachtecha Arai V'Toroscha Keva, or Asei Atoroscha Keva Malachtecha Arai. Make the Torah the main thing in your life, and your parnasa, your material things, secondary. Even if you spend more time by necessity on the physical, material things, they should be the secondary thing in your life, and the Torah should be the ikar. And all those things should be for the sake of Torah. Because in main kemach ain't Torah. If you can't eat, you can't learn Torah. So you have to earn a physical and material parnasa. You have to make a living. But on the other hand, you should understand that that's not the goal of life. Right? That's not the main purpose of life. It says that the Bavloim were foolish people because they used to eat bread with bread. So the rabbis are not interested in telling us the eating habits of the Babylonians, that they ate bread sandwiches. But what it means is the following. If you ask the Babylonian, why are you working so hard to earn a living? He says, because I got to eat. Why do you got to eat? Because I got to earn a living. It was a vicious circle. There was no purpose in eating. The purpose was only to go to work the next day. I used to be a rabbi in Miami. Miami at the time, at least, was a place for retirees to a large degree. A lot of people retired and moved to Miami. And I noticed that many of these people who had been very active their entire lives, and their whole life revolved around earning a living, getting up in the morning, going to work, going back, that was their routine their whole life. Now they finally were free. And what they did is, you know, they played some golf and tennis and watched all the reruns on television, and after that, they used to sit and wait for the Malach HaMavos. They had no purpose to live. Their whole purpose of life, their entire life, was earn a living. And now they didn't have to earn a living. So nothing to do. They didn't realize when they were earning a living, they were earning a living to live. And there had to be some greater purpose in living than just earning a living. Earning a living is the means. It's not the end. But when earning a living becomes the end in itself, then there's no real purpose of a living. And when you don't have to earn a living anymore, and that's why it says, "Ilu nosam lanu es haman, v'lo nosam lanu es haShabbos dayenu." If God had given us the man and not given us Shabbos, it would have been enough to learn the lesson of Shabbos from the man. What's the lesson of Shabbos? 6 days you work, but that's not the goal. That's only a means. The goal is Shabbos is spiritual. You work and earn a living to live. But you live for something much more noble and glorious than this physical world. You're living to create a spiritual, eternal world. That's Shabbos. The Mon taught me that same thing. Because they didn't have to work for a living. They got their sustenance from the heavens. And yet, there still was a purpose to live. If the whole purpose of living is earning a living, then in the desert there was no purpose to live. They had not their own living. But even after you have your living, there's a purpose to live. Now use it for the right purpose. So therefore, the counting of the Omer, which was counting anxiously towards the giving of the Torah, made it that they shouldn't forget Shavuos. In other words, the giving of the Torah and the whole idea of Torah, because they would be so involved in earning a living that they would forget, in quotation marks, the importance of Torah, and what's most important, what's the means and what's the end. That's what the Rokeach means. That they would forget the importance of Torah because they were so involved in earning a living. And the truth is that the Avudram and the Sfarno, two other Rishonim, say a similar idea, but it fits very nicely, it complements this idea. They say that this during this time, the counting of the Omer, they say, was a sign of prayer. Every day they counted the day and put their eyes towards God to pray for two things. One, to thank God for the success of the harvest up until that point. and to pray that it continued to be a success till the end. So every day they prayed for that day, up until that day, and that day forward. And because of that, the Rama says that the days of counting the Omer are days of judgment. Because a person is judged when he's involved in earning a living. Are you earning this living with the right intention or not? Are you earning this living thinking that you're taking God's place? Are you earning this living in order to understand that you're doing it for the purpose of being able to live a Torah life? And this is a means to reach an end, and this is what God wants you to do. So it's a tremendous time of judgment, and that's why during this time, the Midas Hadin, the terrible, harsh judgment, struck down the students of Rabbi Akiva. What was their sin? A Nehem Tzara B'Torasam. They were Torah scholars. They didn't have to earn a living. But they didn't appreciate the real value of Torah. Their eyes were narrow concerning their Torah. And therefore they didn't spread and teach Torah to all the Jewish people. That was another thing. There's three sources of what the sin of Rabbi Akiva's Talmidim was. In one place it says, a Nehem Tzara B'Torasa. Its simple meaning is they were selfish with their Torah, but the literal meaning is the Torah was narrow in their eyes. They didn't really appreciate, that's the way I understand it, the vastness, the breadth and depth of Torah. And, therefore, they didn't bother to spread it to everybody. They didn't see it being central to everybody's life. They were learning Torah, that was what they did. But that they should spread it to all the Jewish people, even the people who were working for a living, what's their place in Torah? And the last thing was, lo nagu kavod zeh bazeh. They didn't treat each other with the proper respect. But it all fits the same thing. If you don't appreciate the real value of Torah, and therefore you don't spread it even to the people who can't do it all the time, but at least they should make that the goal of their life, let them learn Torah too, then you don't respect people who are learning Torah as much, yourself or other people. That's lo nagu kavod. Kavod is Torah. They didn't look at each other with the proper respect. They didn't look at themselves with the proper respect of being Torah scholars, of how important Torah is. And because of that, other people learn from them that Torah is not so important. Even the Torah scholars don't consider it that important. So we working people, why should we kill ourselves, to make time for Torah? Not so important. And therefore, when they died, and there was this terrible tragedy of Torah scholars being killed, it raised the sensitivity of the Jewish people to the importance of Torah scholars. And it atoned for the sin that they did. What they couldn't teach in their life, they taught through their death. That was the idea. And this danger of when a person is involved in earning a living, he forgets how important the Torah is and how much that is the goal, right, and the purpose of everything, comes from two reasons. Kochi va'otzim yodi. A person gets involved in earning a living, he begins to think that it's his power and the strength of his hand that give him his parnasa. And he forgets to realize that he's doing what God wants him to do and there's a purpose for it. He's not just amassing money and making himself a self-made person. Now the Meiri says, Kochi va'otzim yodi does not just mean a redundance of my might and my power. But he says like this, what does a person think? He thinks that he earns his living with his own power, with his own might. Right? He's doing it. He's not just fulfilling a condition and God is giving him the parnasa. It's not a God-given parnasa. It's a self-made, I'm making a living. Right? Kochi, my power makes me my living. What's otsam yadi? Otsam can also mean to close. Atshima seinayim means to close your eyes. He says, person thinks, I made my living with my own hard work. It's a product of my work. And you know how I held on to it? By closing my hand and not giving it to anybody else. Va'otzim yodi. I was able to amass my wealth with my power and my ability to hold on to it. Close my hand. So there's two dangers. One is a person has to know that it's not your power. You're doing what God is going to bless you with success, right, and give you a living. if you will put in the effort, but realize God's giving you that for a purpose. And the purpose is to learn and observe Torah. And you're holding on to it also is not your doing. God will see to it that you'll be able to have if you use it for the right purposes. So we need two things to be counteracted. One, the everyday earning of the living, and the maintenance of it. That's why we count the days and we count the weeks. You count the days, the beginning of the day. I'm going to go harvest tomorrow morning. I'm going to work tomorrow morning. Right? What is the value of my work? Right? God is the one who's going to grant me success. Is he going to grant me success if I'm just doing it for my own animalistic purposes? Or is he going to grant me success if I do it for the right purpose? So the counting of the omer of the day is for to counteract kochi. My might makes my living. I make my living. No. I do what God wants me to do, so he will provide me with a living, and he's obviously providing it me for a much noble purpose. And then we count at the end of the week. At the end of the week, you've already amassed a certain amount of harvest. Now you look back and you say, I have my harvest, I want to hold on to it. Right? Are you holding on to it, or is God giving you the blessing that you should be able to hold on to it? If he is, then holding on to it doesn't mean not giving it to the to aniyim, not giving it to the people you have to give, not taking off shumas and maestras. That's not holding on to it. That's going to ruin it. You're going to hold on to it more if you do with it with what God wants you to do with it. So the counting of the days counteracted the kochi, and the counting of the weeks counteracted the otzim yodi. One was for the daily harvest, and one was for what you accomplished week by week in that harvest. And that's why it says La'omer and Ba'omer. Could be when they counted the days, they said Ba'omer, right? This is in the process. The Omer was a barley sacrifice. Barley is animal food. It represents taking care of your basic animal needs, which are important. You have to eat. You have to be clothed. You need the basic needs that a regular animal needs. And that's important. But by a human being, that's not the end. By an animal, that's the end. And then human beings use the animals. Mm-hmm. But by a human being, it's only a means to reach an end. So we said Ba'omer when we counted the days, and we said La'omer when we counted the weeks. This is back on, since I brought the Omer permits me to use the new harvest for mundane purposes. I'm allowed to eat it. I couldn't eat it before the Omer. So the Omer reminds me that God is the one who's providing my sustenance. I just have to go through the motions. And it's not my power, and it's not the closing of my hand that will ensure that I'll have that those material needs. It's using it for the right purpose. So you counted La'omer, the weeks back. I have now what I've accomplished. How do I hold on to it? Not by closing my hand, by doing with it what God wants. And how did I get it? Not with my own power. God gave me the ability to have that power. That's Ba'omer. And that's why, what's it called, the word Omer has another meaning. The Ksav, the Kabbalah says, the word Omer also has the meaning of being subjugated. Lehis Amer means, lo sisamer bo, don't subjugate, what's it called, says if you take the woman in captive, the captive woman during battle. So if you don't want to marry her, then you can't hold her as a slave. You have to let her go. And the term the Torah uses, right, the way the Torah describes not subjugating this woman is losis amerba, which has the same letters as Omer. So he says Omer can also mean to subjugate yourself, meaning when you think that you're creating your living, and you are, the way I understand it, and you're, what's it called, holding on to your possessions, understand that they're supposed to be subjugated to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and not merely the satisfaction of your animal desires. And therefore the Maral says that that's the whole idea of Sfiras HaOmer. It's to take care of your physical, material needs before we got the Torah. Because it means Kemach in Torah. If there's no flour, there's no Torah. If you don't take care of your physical needs, you can't have the Torah. But you should realize that the physical needs are there, material gains are there for the sake of the Torah. They're the foundation of the Torah. They're not ends in themselves, totally separated from Torah. And therefore the Rashba says there's another aspect of Sfiras HaOmer. Aside from the idea of counting from the Omer, you're counting towards the Shtei HaLechem. On Shavuos, you brought two loaves of bread, of wheat, together with the Shavuos sacrifices, which represented the idea that if there's no Torah, there's no purpose for Kemah. That permitted the new crop to be used in the Beis HaMikdash for the meal offerings or whatever. Until you brought the Shtei HaLechem on Shavuos, you couldn't bring meal offerings from the new crop. You could only bring it from the old crop. So the new crop was initiated by the Shtei HaLechem on Shavuos. So we have the Omer, which permits you to eat from the new crop for your own purposes, and that puts in perspective the preparation of your material needs in light of doing it for the sake of Torah. And then once you have the Torah, it ennobles all the material things in the world and elevates it to be used, mamash, in service of God directly. So you're counting from the means to the end, and it could be that's the reason we count up and not down. Because if we'd only be counting towards the goal, but not from something, we'd have to count down. But if you're counting from here to here, then you count up. Counting from this and building up to the other. And it's dafka in the time when a person is involved in his material pursuits that he can really get this lesson. It's not that you should stop being involved in your material pursuits and remember the Torah. No. It says, Yofa Talmud Torah in Derech Eretz. Talmud Torah is good together with earning a living. Shiyagiyah Shnei HaMashgachas Avah. Because being busy with both of them makes you forget sin. Instead of forgetting the Torah, you forget the sin. Sin is not that important anymore because you're so involved in earning a living so you'll be able to learn Torah. Now, your whole life revolves around that. There's no time for sinning. Not that you forget the sin completely, it's unimportant. Why would I want to be involved in things that are totally detrimental to my whole purpose in life? So therefore, they didn't count in the day and stop harvesting. You continue harvesting in the day. At night, when you're not harvesting, then you'll combine your harvest in the day with your learning of Torah at night. That's the ideal. And that's why the Rabbeinu Yerucham, another Rishon, says that Sfiras HaOmer corresponds to the idea of this whole world revolving around sevens, right? That like Shabbos, 6 days, the seventh. It hints to the Elef HaShvi. The world was created for 6,000 years, and the 7,000th year is the goal, is Olam Haba. Whatever that means. It's not necessarily to be taken literally, but there, and it could be that there's a Yovel. There's seven times that. But whatever it is, the cycle of this world and the next world revolves around the number seven. This world is six, and that's the seventh. But that's the concept. The concept is this world is the physical, material world. The means, the end, is the seventh, is the Shabbos, is Olam Haba. So the whole concept of Sfiras HaOmer is to bring home this idea that all the physical things, the entire physical world, this world, is a means to reach an end, which is the Yom Shekulo Shabbos, which is Olam Haba. And therefore the Tzedek L'Derech says, another idea, and it also fits into this, that the idea of the seven, counting seven days, seven times, towards the giving of the Torah, represents the seven planets. And even though there are nine planets, right, but planets, what a planet is a very arbitrary thing. Because they found that there's planets beyond Pluto. So how close does it have to be part of the solar system? How much not? How big? Whatever. So whether Pluto's a planet or not is also an argument among science. It depends on what you set as your criteria. So the Torah set the criteria that only there are seven Kochvei Leches, seven planets, right? And they represent the world of nature, astrology-wise. right? That the influence that God gives to the world comes from through the stars and through the planets. So what does it tell me? It tells me that all of the natural, physical world, which is under the planets, it says Bani, children, Chayi, and how long you're going to live, and Mizoni are all already decreed from heaven and put through the influence of this natural world. You can go beyond that. You can add years to your life. If you weren't supposed to have children, you could have children, like Avraham Avinu. Right? If you weren't supposed to have Parnasa, you could have Parnasa. We can go beyond nature. But the seven planets represent the natural world. And therefore, the whole idea of Sefiras HaOmer is how to use the natural world for its right purpose, as a means to an end, not an end in itself. And lastly, the Rokeach himself says another idea, that it's opposite the 50 gates of wisdom. We count 50 days, opposite the 50 gates of wisdom, Bina. Bina is what you get after you have Chochma. Chochma is the base. But now that you have Chochma, you have to understand what its implications are. You build on it. What does it mean? Same thing. The physical, material world is the base. But what's its purpose? What's its goal? Right? It's not there as an end in itself. Just like the wisdom isn't an end in itself, it's to be built on and used and applied. So too, the physical world is like the wisdom. But the purpose of it is the Bina. So the counting of the Omer corresponds to the 50 gates of Bina, which is understanding the basics and understanding what their implications and how to apply them, which applies equally to wisdom and applies to the physical, natural, material things in the world. Okay, that is a one way of looking at Sefiras HaOmer that includes a lot of different things, yeah?
Where does Das fit into this?
Das is the combination of both, usually. First comes Chochma, the facts. You amass facts, data, information. Then comes the Bina. Now I have to understand what that information means. How do I apply it? And Das is the actual application.
Sorry, what was the source for the last idea?
The Rokeach. Same Rokeach that we started with, yeah? He says a different idea also. But it fits with that first idea.
You have to have Chochma before you have Bina?
What?
You have to have Chochma before you have Bina.
Pretty much, because you can't understand the implication of something if you don't know what it is, to begin with. So first you have to have Chochma, then you can have Bina. You can have the qualities of Chochma and Bina and Das all together. But the actual development of it, first you need the Chochma, you need the what's it called, the facts. Then you need the quality of Bina to analyze those facts, and then you need the Das to put it into practice.
So women don't have Bina more than that. The
Gemara says, Bina Yaseira, Nitna Be'isha, Yosef Be'ish. Women were given an extra quality of Bina. But there's a partnership. The men in this world are the ones who create the Chochma. They learn Torah. Mm-hmm. And they come up with the facts. What's Halacha? What's the fact? That's what they spend all day doing. And then the women take those facts and apply them, right, and understand what their implications and applications are. That's called making an environment where those facts can be lived. That's Bina. Bina is a base, bias. It's a home. It's the environment. That's what Bina Yaseira, which explains a Gemara that I wouldn't tell you if I didn't have an explanation for it. The Gemara says that a very important woman came to the Beis Medrash, I think a Reb Zeira, I don't remember now who it was, I just learned it recently and I still can't remember who it was. One of the Amoraim. And she had a question. She said, if all of the people who served the golden calf did the same sin, why were there three different kinds of death penalties? Some were killed by the Levium, some were killed by a plague, and some were killed when Moshe made them drink the waters mixed with the ashes of a golden calf like a sota. So the Amora said to her, go home and knit. Ain chachma le'isha ela bepelech. A woman's wisdom is limited to knitting. Go home and knit. So you would think, okay, maybe it was a stupid question. But it wasn't a stupid question. The Gemara discusses it for the next page and comes up with the answer. Why tackle with the three? Why don't you just tell her, have a seat, we'll discuss it, we'll get back to you, great question. And so she was an important woman and smart. Why didn't tell her, go home and knit? So I think what he missed telling her is the following. There are two roles over here. Your question is a great question, but it's an abstract question. That's the role of a man. A man is supposed to create the threads of wisdom, right? What they are. What, right? We'll discuss this for the next 10 days, right? It's a totally abstract question. What happened in the past? Why it was like that? We're going to discuss it, right? Your job is to knit. What's knitting? Taking threads and putting them into a framework where they're usable. You'll come after what we do. Go home, take the threads that we create here and knit them into a, not knit a yarmulke or a sweater, right? Go and knit the Torah knowledge into a framework that it can be used. That's your role. If you're going to sit here and duplicate our role, who's going to do your role? So the woman's wisdom is more the pelech, more the knitting together of the threads that men are supposed to create. Men create the threads. The women then make them something practical and apply them and understand their implications. That's what he told her.
But under that, like, mashal, though, so but it's still good for the woman to have asked the question because it inspires the men.
Right, but he said, but he basically said, don't sit here and just duplicate, right? You go home and get from all the things that we create in this base medrash and take it the next step. Because if you're not going to take it the next step, you're just going to duplicate what we're doing. Who's going to do what you're supposed to do?
Right, but there wasn't a criticism here of her asking the question. It was good
right,
to ask
exactly,
the question.
Right, exactly. But this is not your role to sit here and ask these kind of questions. Right. Your role is to take what will come from, go home and knit it, put it into a framework. Right. So now, why did you tell her that? Why didn't you just tell her the way I said it? Right. So the truth is, it was because she was such an important and great woman. Let me tell you how the rabbis spoke to each other, okay? Which on the surface seems, right, we're talking about Talmid Rabbi Akiva, didn't treat each other with respect. Let me tell you what the Gemara says, how different rabbis spoke to each other in the Gemara. Right? One Gemara says that one rabbi asked another one a question, and the first one said, if you could ask a question like that, you don't have a brain in your head. Literally, that's what it says, right? Or that is the stupidest question I ever heard, or something like that. Those kind of, they know, so it's there, really. The Rishonim also, why? Now the answer is, because of their greatness. We can't speak like that to each other. Because our personal honor is important to us, sometimes even more important than the truth. Okay, therefore we have to sugarcoat everything, be nice. And the rabbis of the Talmud had one interest. What is the truth? They realize that they are responsible for passing on the tradition, right? The Mesorah. Tradition sounds like something out of Fiddler on the Roof. But tradition we mean from Har Sinai, right? God's word to the future. It has to be true. And if it's not true, then they are causing destruction for future generations. So therefore, what was important to them was not their personal honor, right? It was the truth. And therefore, how do you come to the truth? We argue it out. That's the way the Torah was given, right? That there's ways of learning or whatever, and they learned the Chavrusa, and they argued with each other. Like it's like a war, okay? Now, if you think what I said is idiocy, then you tell me that. Don't sugarcoat it. Because I will defend it if I can, and if not, maybe you'll convince me that it's wrong. And in the end, we'll come to the truth. Because that's the Iker. The Iker is not, I should be right or you should be right. The Iker is what is right. And therefore their own personal honor meant nothing. And therefore they wanted to be told the way it was, not sugarcoated. It would have been an insult to sugarcoat it as if, you think my honor is more important than truth? If you really think that this is idiocy, tell me it's idiocy. I may defend it, fight you, but at least I'll know what you think, so we'll know, we'll come to the truth better. They assumed that this woman was on the same level. And therefore they didn't mince words and didn't sugarcoat it. They told her as it was, because it was important enough to tell it as it was. Right? When you have, for instance, I make an example how that would be. If you have, let's say, somebody who's dealing with something that's extremely, extremely dangerous, or radioactive materials or whatever, okay? And he does something that could mamish cause an atomic explosion or whatever, right? You don't start telling him, hey, I don't think you're really carrying that thing the right way. You scream out, drop it, right? You idiot! Well, because it's important enough, that's how you have to talk. You can't sugarcoat it or whatever, and then after the atomic explosion, you know, right. So I think that's a good mashal.